This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Sadly, we know all too well how an assassination can affect our lives and our country. The murders of John F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King Jr. immediately come to mind, and we wonder what motivates these killers, what they hope to achieve. A new book divides them into three categories: professionals, or jackals, who kill on orders or for money; passionate amateurs, foxes, who kill for a cause; and social misfits in search of fame, lone wolves. Author Chris Hollington provides many examples of each over the past 55 years, the notorious cases we all know about and many we've forgotten. He reminds us that assassination can play a defining role in world events, that it often backfires when used by governments, and he delves into the psyche of that most elusive and most American of assassins, the lone wolf. Later in the hour, we'll remember Isaac Hayes, but first, assassins and motives. We'll talk first about lone wolves. What do you think motivates Arthur Bremer, a Mark David Chapman, or a David Hinckley? Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also now reach us on Twitter. If you're a user of that online discussion tool, you can find us at twitter.com/TOTN. Chris Hollington joins us now from the studios of the BBC in London. His book is called Wolves, Jackals, and Foxes, The Assassins Who Changed History. And it's nice to have you today on Talk of the Nation.
Nice to be here.
And in one of your most interesting chapters, you get a look at part of a Secret Service survey of attacks of American presidents and the motives and methodology of lone wolves.
Called the Exceptional Case Study Project. It's a fascinating study of lone wolves and attackers on presidents and other VIPs in America over the past 50 years or so. And they found some very interesting patterns, although, you know, they're sort of quick to point out there's no surefire way of a sort of assassination personality type, but there were some interesting correlations.
And interestingly, you come to the conclusion that most of the time anyway, these are psychodramas, not political dramas.
Exactly. It's just all within the troubled mind of a lone individual, just something that they're playing out, almost a movie in their mind, if you like.
And there's also something you describe as the pathway to attack.
Yes, indeed. This is the sort of the steps that sort of take someone who may be nurturing an idea, because these things don't happen instantly. These people, they nurture these ideas over a long period of time and gradually lead up to them by going through a number of stages. There was a teenager was arrested just a few days ago in America who the Secret Service think may have been plotting to assassinate George Bush, and he'd been acquiring information about Bush's ranch and collecting weaponry, which was quite impressive, if not quite worrying as well.
It had a map of a route of a presidential motorcade.
Exactly, yes. One of the most vulnerable times to attack a president. Although, I must say that George Bush's limousine is one of the most secure vehicles in the world.
And I have to say, the presidential convoy occasionally runs past our building here in Washington, D.C., and it's quite an impressive sight, and there are duplicates of every car. It would be hard to figure out which car he was actually in.
Absolutely. There are two limos on every convoy, and it is indeed an impressive sight. In fact, one of the most impressive things I've ever seen about it is when he goes to the more dangerous parts of the world and goes on his convoy, then there's a special SUV with a hidden minigun in it. So the roof pops up and a guy pops out with a basically the kind of gun you find on an M16 or something like that. It's an F-16, I should say.
The White House, you say, receives something on the order of about 500 threats a month. But interestingly, you say, one of the factors in these lone wolves who actually did make some sort of an attempt is that they rarely make threats.
Yes, there's something they keep to themselves, which kind of makes sense. I mean, it's that they're usually withdrawn loners who've had an overbearing mother and a dominating father, so they internalize a lot, so they're very quiet. And one of the things that people always say, you know, when journalists ask friends and relatives, say, well, tell us about him, what was he like, and they know very little about him.
He was such a quiet boy.
Yeah, absolutely, those are exactly the words.
And they are characterized, again, there are certainly exceptions, but tend to be young men in their 20s and white.
Yes, strangely enough, there are these striking patterns. Young men, white, in their 20s, loners, sort of middle-class backgrounds, quite wealthy parents, but just something in them just seems to prevent them from succeeding or taking their life in a certain direction. Very often, they've said, the Secret Service study found that these men wanted, they said it would have been nice to have had help on their way, on their pathway to attack. If someone had intervened, then they would have responded to that. But it's obviously very difficult to do.
We're speaking with Chris Hollington, a British journalist, the author of Wolves, Jackals and Foxes, The Assassins Who Changed History. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. Let's start with Steve, and Steve's on the line from Cleveland in Ohio.
Yes. Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Fine. Good. I really have to strongly disagree with both of your theories about the lone wolf, because I really think that these are individuals who have very strong political feelings, number one. Number two, I think these are people that have very intense and very compassionate and empathetic feelings for the human race in general, but I think what really triggers that individual to take that final step over the edge are, you know, you're right, and there are personal situations in that individual's life that, you know, push them in that direction. And these may be things that, you know, are on beyond that individual's control, or perhaps within their control. Maybe they didn't make the right decision, you know, one way or the other. But I think it is a very complex mindset for an individual to take that step. I think if you're talking about somebody who wants to carry out an attack against the celebrity, a non-political individual, I think we're talking about a completely different profile. I think the political attacker, assassin, lone wolf, as you were, I think it's much more complex.
Well, let's see if we get an answer.
Letting on to
Steve,
me.
Let's see if we get an answer.
Well, you're right, but that's one of the problems with getting down to defining assassinations and the different types of assassins, because we had Hinckley and Bremer, you mentioned in your introduction. Mm-hmm. Both of them just switched targets. It didn't matter to them. Bremer made it clear, you know, he wanted to go for Nixon, but when he couldn't get close to Nixon, he chose Wallace because he was more accessible. And that was a big factor in Hinckley's decision as well to go for Reagan. He, you know, previously stalked Carter, but when he saw Carter was going to lose the election, then he went for Reagan because he'd make a bigger splash. I mean, certainly there are the lone political assassin is very rare, but the assassin who is perhaps part of a political group is someone like Saddam Hussein, perhaps, who, as many people don't know, as a young man, was part of a group of men who tried to assassinate the then leader of Iraq, the British installed leader whose name escapes me for the moment. But again, those sorts of lone assassins are motivated by political ideals. So there are different types, but the recent cases we've seen in the United States are largely sprung from in psychodrama rather than the sort of politics.
I don't agree.
All right, Steve. Thanks very much for the call anyway.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. Let's see if we get Tim on the air. Tim's with us from Edmond, Oklahoma.
I have three brief points. First of all, I appreciate the author's seriousness of purpose and his scholarship, and so I understand that, but I have real fundamental questions about the premise and study itself. I've taught history for 40 years, and I have a policy. I never mention the name of an assassin in class or in any publication. I don't think people who do this deserve to be credited in any way.
If they're after notoriety, Chris Hollington, why do you give it to them?
Very interesting point. Well, it's inescapable. I mean, you could apply that point then to, you know, all sorts of people who've been responsible for unpleasant acts. But I think, and many people are now coming to think as well, that assassinations are the key points in history. They're very interesting because they're at a point where history can go down one road or another. So they need to be studied because there's such, you know, dramatic moments that can absolutely utterly transform history. I can understand the sensitivity of you know, discussing such a person, but I mean, that doesn't really matter. I mean, Bremer doesn't care. Bremer is out of jail now and trying to live as obscure as he possibly can. You know, these guys are not who still survive are not looking for notoriety anymore. Same with Hinckley, just to use those two examples. But by studying them, you know, we can have a better understanding of why they do what they do, and perhaps preventing them in the future, and also protecting our leaders too. I mean, we have to mention their names. We can't be helped. But there are lots of nasty individuals throughout history who you know we simply name because they're part of history.
Tim, you had another point?
Well, yes, I do. And he could meet both of. We could have a middle ground here if he would just have a dramatis personae at the front of the book and use only pseudonyms or Assassin 1, Assassin 2, Assassin 3. My point is they don't deserve the credit. Someone who kills Henry IV does not deserve to be remembered on the same page as Henry IV. The last thing, and this, for those of us who are old enough to remember the period of time when Mr. Ford was shot at, there was this awful sense at the time that, you know, if you take a shot at somebody, we'll put you on the cover of Newsweek. And again, it's the notoriety aspect. There's I think the newspaper record should have this information, but I see no reason. If I were doing a book like this, I would have had a list of pseudonyms, and I would have divorced. I would have kept the scholarship there, but I would have just said, you know, there's no reason to remember that guy's name.
Well, interesting point. I don't know if anyone would do that with a history book. I mean, the history is the truth, no matter how unpleasant and how unfortunate it is. I don't think anyone's... My book is certainly not trying to promote or do these assassins any favours. And some of these assassins might be seen in a positive light. It may sound strange, but there are many assassins who have struck a blow for freedom by removing tyrants and dictators. So it's swings and roundabouts, really.
We'll talk more about assassins and assassination and its role in history in a moment and hear about, well, some of the ones used by governments that backfired. Our guest is Chris Hollington. His book is Wolves, Jackals, and Foxes, The Assassins Who Changed History. Our phone number, if you'd like to join us, is 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The methods they used are as varied as their motives, but assassins do share some things in common. Friday is the most popular day for assassins, especially if the target is a head of state. April, the most common month, followed closely by November. The location, well, most assassinations happen at home, and most with a gun, the weapon of choice. These are some of the facts that Chris Hollington lays out in his book, Wolves, Jackals, and Foxes. He's our guest today, and we're talking about the minds and motives of assassins. If you'd like to talk with him about what drives someone to kill, our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also check out our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And Chris Hollington, one of the things you point out in the book is that several prominent assassins have been found to have copies of Day of the Jackal in their possession, and indeed that the Spanish assassins, the Basque assassins rather, who blew up a Spanish prime minister, went to see the movie.
Yes, I know it seems absolutely incredible, but I guess they're in a way they're kind of doing their research, or you know, who knows? Maybe they're trying to get in the mindset of an assassin, and that book does do it particularly well. It is peculiar. Maybe they're just trying to do their research.
Maybe would you be concerned that to some degree your book might be used as a how-to book, that some assassin in the future will be found to have a copy of Wolves, Jackals, and Foxes?
I don't think so. I don't think it will sort of give them any clue. If anything, what I'm hoping is that it will give those who protect VIPs the sort of the knowledge to do that better. It's definitely not a how-to book. It's a history book, and it tackles a subject which has sort of been largely neglected, an important subject which I think has been neglected in some respects.
Twitter user Juan Navarro asks, so what about the victims of assassins? Are their targets peacemakers, war makers, revolutionaries?
Sorry, say that again.
Who are the victims?
Oh, who are the victims of assassins? Oh, gosh, yeah, absolutely anybody who's considered an important person. I mean, it's most often it's. I mean, assassination is defined as the removal of someone of an important person in the hope that their ideas die with them. So you're sort of working with that framework. It's the person with ideas. A recent case of Benazir Bhutto is a good case where you know, her assassination's completely changed the political scene in Pakistan, absolutely transformed it.
Let's see if we can get Matt on the line. Matt's calling us from St. Louis.
I wanted to know how you would classify two different assassins, one of them being, of course, Lee Harvey Oswald, and the other one being the Serbian gentleman who killed the Archduke of Austria starting World War I.
Gavrilo Princip.
Oh, yes. Well, they're both very interesting characters. I mean, Oswald is interesting because he's a bit of a lone wolf, but he's also perhaps a bit of a fox as well, because he had very strong political views. But yeah, I mean, his psychology is endlessly fascinating, I think. But he seemed to me just to be a real puny man, a real loser, mentally, you know, below average, but somehow there was something in him that allowed him to commit the crime of the century, which is, you know, deeply disturbing. And, you know, it's very hard to accept that someone so disturbed and should have been ineffectual was able to remove the most powerful man on the planet. Similarly, Gavro Princip, he was perhaps a disturbed character, but he worked with a political group to achieve his ends. So he was a mixture of you know these two. So you know these types I've outlined, they're not, you know, hard and fast. There are, you know, they do indeed cross over.
But a passionate amateur might be Princip.
Absolutely, yes. I would heartily agree with that.
Matt, thanks very much for the call. Interestingly, as you looked at that Secret Service study of lone wolves, one of the things that they found was that the psychology of the lone wolf is not all that different. The profile is similar to that of a spree killer. And indeed, one of the people you write about is Joseph Paul Franklin, who shot at, among others, Larry Flint and Vernon Jordan, but was eventually connected with 20 different murders.
Yes, incredibly. He was perhaps the first serial assassin. I mean, there are, he's slightly different from a spree killer. A spree killer is usually someone who loses it and then will kill a lot of people all at once, and then usually take their own lives or will be killed by the authorities in the ensuing battle. Franklin was fascinating. I mean, usually these spree killers, they're quite similar characters, but they usually have a feeling that they've been wronged somehow by society or a leader, and they sort of strike out against them. And this crosses over with some lone wolf assassins the crazy foxes. In that, and it very often it's defined by accessibility. If they feel they've got access to the president, then perhaps they will strike at the president, and then you've got your lone assassin. And if not, then they'll just strike out at whoever's happens to be closest at the time. With Franklin was a one-off. He was this half-blind, but extremely effective sniper who took out, as you know, we hadn't, and until the Washington sniper, we hadn't seen anything like it since. A man who went round traveling across the USA, robbing banks, and then shooting dead people who were in mixed race couples, because he was a complete racist, and he wanted to start a race war. That was his ambition, and it got to such a point where he was so successful at this that he decided he was going to target Jimmy Carter, but fortunately that failed, and then he tried to strike out.
Saved by a swamp rabbit.
Saved by a swamp rabbit, yes indeed. A very famous photograph of Jimmy Carter splashing around near his farm on a boat with a swamp rabbit, a very angry and rabid swamp rabbit sort of paddling towards him. Somewhere in the bushes, Joseph Franklin was waiting to take him out. But thanks to the swamp rabbit, Carter left sooner than planned. So perhaps, you know, that rabbit saved his life.
Yeah, but it did inspire the immortal headline, as you point out, in the Washington Post, President Attacked by Rabbit.
Yes, indeed. Great headline.
Let's go to Anthony. Anthony with us from Casper, Wyoming.
Good afternoon. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
You made a comment about the White House currently getting 500 threats a month. This might be out of context. Who has the most of American presidency's threats posed against them? If just out of curiosity, we were wondering ourselves.
Yeah, sure. That's a good question. I do happen to know that. I do know that in 1974, President Nixon received 300 threats for the entire year. Now, the current president receives 500 a month, and that is a record.
And is that a function of that particular presidency, or have they been arcing steadily upwards ever since?
They've been going up, but I think I remember Clinton famously once complained that he didn't have enough threats against his life, so he suggested he wasn't going to go down in history as a great president because people didn't want to see him dead, which is an unusual thing to say. But I think recently the Secret Service has improved. It's an amazing agency now, and they're able to spot a lot more threats, and they pay attention a lot more to threats. So that's why they're simply recording many more threats than they used to.
Thanks, Anthony.
Yes, sir. Y'all take care.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Thanks.
I did want to get into the cases of government uses of assassination, by far the smallest proportion, but nevertheless, that's some of the more interesting cases, including one that you say had dramatic effects on the country of the Congo ever since the murder of Patrice Lumumba back in the 1960s.
Yes, as you say, Lumumba was an almost unique case in that he took over the Democratic Republic of the Congo, as it became known, and did a fine job of trying to hand as much of the country's wealth back to the people. But the business interests, in particular Belgium, UK and America, who had a lot of mining concessions there, were not happy about this. When Lumumba threatened to nationalise the, I think it was the tin mine, no, copper mines, he really caused a, he made a great many powerful enemies. And what happened, this has all been now completely proven, is that the Americans, the British and the Belgian governments conspired together to assassinate Lumumba, between them and using Lumumba's enemies, of which he had plenty in the Congo, they managed to execute him. But it was a most extraordinary case. I mean, it was in 63, just before...
Just weeks before John Kennedy would have become president, who had a very different view of Patrice Lumumba.
Yeah, who would have stepped in. Eisenhower, you know, wanted him gone, and Kennedy, you know, could possibly have saved his life. So, yes, a unique and fascinating but a terrible case of governments conspiring to assassinate a leader. And, you know, the country, as we sadly know now, never really recovered.
There is also the case, you mentioned Saddam Hussein earlier, an attempted, a would-be assassin in his youth. But there are plenty of other examples of people who were involved in assassination who later rose to become leaders in their country, including in the Congo. But you also point out in Iran today.
Oh, yes. Yes, exactly. The current leader of Iran, extremely... disturbing to know that this man is actually in control of a very large and powerful nation. I think we probably have good reason to be a little bit worried, because Ahmadinejad he worked his way through the secret police. He was became an assassin and later became ran one of the most gruesome execution factories that's ever gone in record. I forget his nickname at the moment, but he was given an absolutely horrific nickname.
Thousand Bullets, wasn't it?
Something like that, yes. Who were just, you know, these poor people in Iran would be tortured and then executed. And he was basically in charge of this prison that controlled all this. And he worked his way up through that, through killing people, working as abroad in assassination squads. A really, frightening man.
How well documented do you think that case is? Are you concerned that anti-Iranian and specifically anti-Mahmoud Ahmadinejad propaganda might have affected that disinformation, if you will?
Oh, what now, you mean?
Yeah.
I wouldn't be too worried about, you know, having, you know, giving them any more negative propaganda than they already have. And I think the Iranians would probably, or his supporters anyway, would be quite happy with us knowing what a, you know, fearsome man he is, someone to be really reckoned with.
We're talking with Chris Hollington, the author of Wolves, Jackals and Foxes, The Assassins Who Changed History. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's get Fred from Burlingame, California on the line.
Yeah. Yeah, hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
I'd like to know, why is it that these assassins and serial killers, why do they kill themselves after their accomplishment? Why don't they bask in the glory of their triumphs? And I'm curious about that. If they're so crazy to do these things, why don't they enjoy the accomplishment? And the other thing is, there's two celebrated assassins in South Africa. They're the assassin of Heinrich Borwood was a Greek colored, and he was put in a mental institution, and Mandela posthumously gave him an award. And then there was a Polish immigrant to South Africa who, along with Darby Lewis, assassinated Christopher Hani. And that guy was absolutely crazy, was considered a KGB agent that the South Africans had flipped into becoming an anti-communist. And
let's see if we get an answer. By the way, that first story is told in the book. In fact, I was surprised. And again, I guess it depends on the type of assassin, Chris Hollington. But 30% of the assassins, according to your chart, get away.
Yes, absolutely. Not all of them want notoriety in the sense. And very often, I mean, the ones that are caught, they do end up in jail. So it's very hard for them to get much publicity. Thinking of the assassination, would-be assassin of the Pope, Mehmet Aksa. He, languished in jail until quite recently. He made the news again, but, he's gone off the radar. So I don't think they get much chance to...
of course, the man who shot Pope John Paul.
Yes, exactly. They don't get much chance to bask in glory, except perhaps in a very limited circle if they do escape. And many of them do, but the more famous ones, they do tend to be caught and put away and largely forgotten about. Certainly, they don't get a public voice.
Let's get Matt on the line. Matt's with us from Tucson, Arizona.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
I was curious, when you mentioned the jackals or the paid assassins, you also mentioned how the Secret Service can really they stop a lot of threats to the president and such. How
yes.
many of those? I mean, is it very often that it's a paid assassin?
Oh, one wouldn't think so.
Yeah, I would. But you're the author, so I thought you might be able to tell me.
That's a good question. No, I mean, in the United States, I don't think there's as far as I'm aware, in my own research, I mean, there are many cases, of course, we don't know exactly what the outcomes were. But I've never heard of a case of someone being a paid assassin, paid to take out a United States president.
Well, I thought maybe with your undercover access, you could shed light on that.
Okay,
I have met a paid hitman in London, and that was a very scary experience, I have to say. But the paid hitmen tend to be very different. People who assassinate presidents, they tend to be either political or just plain crazy. Hitmen who are paid do tend to, they're focusing usually on other criminals because they're being paid by criminals to assassinate. The professional hitman is a very, very rare breed in outside of the world of criminality.
And the movies, yeah.
Yes.
But did he answer the question, how much?
Sorry, how much?
How much would he charge for an assassination?
Oh, yes, well, it was about, it depended on the importance and the difficulty of the job, but it was about £10,000, so $20,000.
$20,000 around. Yeah. So life is not cheap.
No, well, some would say that's quite cheap, I think. I thought it was quite cheap.
Have you taken him up on his offer?
No, absolutely not. I mean, he said he was retired, and I'm a criminal journalist by trade, which is how I managed to meet him. It wasn't at all easy. Let me say that. But it was very, very unnerving meeting someone and sitting in front of someone whom you knew if someone paid them enough, then they would kill you. It's nothing personal. It's just for the money.
Just business.
Yeah.
Chris, thanks very much for being with us today.
Pleasure. Enjoyed it.
Chris Hollington is the author of Wolves, Jackals, and Foxes, The Assassins Who Changed History. And he joined us from the studios of the BBC in London. Up next, the man behind Hot Buttered Soul, who called himself the Black Moses. We remember Isaac Hayes with Two Who Knew Him Well. And with you. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. You can also send us email talk@npr.org. www.newsweek.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.